I was late getting music started, so now we're late getting the lecture started, so I might talk fast, and you can just keep up. I think I left a lot of stuff in your outline that wasn't even fill in the blanks. I just felt like it was more necessary to have it than to have you write it, than to worry about making it fancy. So that's why a lot of it, if it makes you stay awake to write, just doodle. I have to do that. I doodle all the time if I'm not taking notes, because it's the only way I can pay attention. All right, so tonight we're in Ruth 3, verse 16, through chapter 4, verse 8. Real quick, I don't know about you, but, I mean, we have covered the details of this transaction many times over, and they're so foreign to us that even though we keep saying them over and over again, I feel like we just hear it and don't absorb it and understand it. So God gave me an analogy in modern day times, if you'll bear with it, to help us get a mental picture of what was going on. I'm not going to pretend it's really what was going on, but just to understand some of the dynamics from this episode in our story. Okay, a little bit back from Brenda's teaching and a little bit from this passage. So imagine a scene that involves a marketing girl. Okay, I was going to say marketing guy, but a marketing gal. A young intern and a business manager, okay? The marketing gal gets a great idea for a business situation and instructs her intern to share the information with the business manager. This super ambitious intern goes to share this proposal with the business manager, but she also adds in a few ideas of her own that she thought would enhance the deal and make it a better outcome. The business manager is agreeable to the proposal, but first he must run it by the board because he knows there's one member with first dibs on the new projects that come along. You with me so far? The board member is about to take on this new project until the additional part of the proposal is suggested as proposed by this ambitious intern, and this board member decides to decline due to low prospect for his return, okay? The business manager is then free and clear to proceed with the project and signs a deal with the board, ensuring that no other members can stake claim to his idea or project at a later date. Meanwhile, back at the office, the marketing gal and the ambitious intern are waiting for results, feeling somewhat hopeful of the outcome, but still not completely sure. Does that help? When I was laying in bed last night and I couldn't fall asleep, and this started going through my mind, and I was like, oh my gosh, that is so perfect, Lord. Please help me remember it when I wake up. And I told Michaela, I always think of things as I'm drifting off, and then I cannot remember them. And this time, he put it right in my head without me even having to think about what it was, so I knew it was him. So anyway, I thought that would help us get a better idea of what was going on here, okay, without having to think about all the cultural stuff that doesn't make sense to us. All right, so I'm going to read this first part of our passage, chapter 3, verses 16 to 18. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, meaning Naomi said, "Is that you, my daughter?" Now, I didn't put this in the teaching, but a lot of things that I read, it wasn't that she didn't really think it was Naomi. Ruth, that was just a customary way of saying, hey, you know, is that you coming in the door? What happened? Tell me what's going on. Stuff like that. It was just a customary greeting. Then she told her all that the man had done for her, and she said, "These 6 ephahs of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" Then she said, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day." So the first part of our teaching tonight is on those three verses, and it's about waiting. And we all know that waiting is not, I don't know a person in here who would say that waiting is easy, right? And we've all had our share. I know Paula has shared several times her situation over the past several months of waiting. I might refer to you, so I'm asking permission ahead of time in front of everyone. Okay, no pressure. Don't feel pressured to say no. Okay, so we have different types of waiting here in this story. 3 kinds of waiting: waiting to determine God's will, waiting to discover God's will, and waiting to do God's will. The first one we're going to cover is waiting to discover God's will, and that's what Naomi had to do. She was back at home waiting to hear the outcome, discovering what God's will would be over the situation. She hatched the plan, she put it into motion, and her idea really was for Ruth to be cared for. Some things that I read, and I might repeat myself, but the terminology that Naomi used really was, let's find a husband for you, not let's get a redeemer for us. It was, she was really concerned about Ruth having a husband. And the idea of her washing and changing clothes and putting on perfume was outward expressions of, okay, it's time for you to get out of your stinky mourning clothes, you know, because they had a period of mourning and they had to keep on these certain clothing, certain garments that show that they were in mourning and not bathe and not put on perfume, which I suppose helped repel any potential suitors. So, that's right. So, she told her, you need to get a bath and put on some perfume and change these clothes and look like you're ready to move on to the next chapter of your life and go do it. And as we've talked about before, culturally, Boaz could not propose to Ruth because he was older and because she didn't have a brother-in-law to provide to the role of levirate marriage. So then it was up to her. As far as that whole thing went, if a brother wasn't there to do it, then she had to propose. So it was kind of multifaceted. So Naomi tells her to do this. Ruth goes on. And then you know that Ruth left at dinner time and didn't come home till the next morning. So Naomi was home for at least 12 hours. If you, any of us, had a daughter that we sent out into an uncertain situation overnight, I wouldn't sleep. I'm sure Naomi didn't sleep. But there she was waiting. And she could have fallen apart. She could have been tempted to start thinking the worst, let her imagination get the best of her, right? But we're hoping that she didn't. She seemed calm when Ruth came home. She didn't tackle her to the ground and say, oh, my gosh, I'm glad you're safe, you know. She just said, hey, what's the word? So the point with this one is that the enemy will bait us while we wait. And I'm saying that because I know for me, that's my kind of MO, is when I start thinking I don't know what's going on and I'm nowhere around it to find out, my imagination's going to get the best of me and the enemy only has to plop a tiny little seed into my head and it goes crazy like wildfire. So the enemy will bait us while we wait, but we have a weapon. And Psalm 27:14 says, wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. That's New King James. And New Living is very similar, but the wording is a little bit different. Wait patiently for the Lord. Be brave and courageous. Yes, wait patiently for the Lord. So that's Psalm 27, which is a weapon for us. If we focus on the Lord while we're waiting, then we don't have to let the enemy, he can bait us all he wants, but we don't have to take the bait, right? We don't have to give in to that temptation. So the next point is, by focusing on Jesus during the waiting, the enemy is stifled. I guess you could say he's stymied, but I use stifled. And then I looked up the definition for stifled after the word came to my head. Here's the great part of this definition. It means to cut off oxygen or voice or to make difficult to do things. Is that wonderful? So when we focus on Jesus, we stifle the enemy. We cut off the air and he can't breathe. He can't, it's like, when I extinguish jar candles, I just put the lid on top and let it snuff out by itself. It's like that. It's a great thing. So the second kind of waiting was where we see with Boaz. He was waiting to determine God's will. This one's a little bit different. He didn't sit idle waiting to see if the nearer relative, he said, there's a nearer relative, there's a closer relative than me who can perform this duty for you. But he didn't wait around for this guy to show up. He went and pursued the situation. He went to the gate and found this guy, which I haven't read that passage, but I know you guys have studied it. He didn't wait for the guy to come out of the blue to claim the property. Boaz took action based on reason and logic and what the laws were and the customs. And then he waited on the Lord to determine the outcome. So he was active and he was strategic. I shared that with my group. I feel like we're going to get into it in a second, but the way he shared the information with this other near, closer relative, it was very strategic on his part. We know the character and faith of Boaz, and it wouldn't surprise me if he had already been considering this as something he would like to have happen. But as we said, culturally, he couldn't put the plan into effect. So imagine how excited and relieved he probably was when Ruth came to him. He didn't jump the gun. He just waited and continued to seek the Lord in the matter. And then when the Lord proposed or, you know, revealed the proper time, he jumped on it then, but he waited. Okay. And then he acted. So Psalm 37, 4 through 9, I'm going to read it and then I'll explain why I'm reading that verse. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your justice as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret, it only causes harm. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. So there's a whole lot going on in that verse. But first of all, these God giving him the desires of his heart, God plants those desires within us when we're seeking him. And then he helps us pursue them, and then he brings them to pass. I mean, if it's a desire he's put within us, he's going to make it happen, right? And then it also says, don't fret because of other people who prosper. Boaz could have gotten really wigged out about the fact that he knew there was somebody else who could provide this role for Ruth. And he didn't let that freak him out. And then the other one was, those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the earth. You know, he was going, I keep jumping ahead, but part of this was not just a romantic love for Ruth. It was a duty to his countrymen, practically. Okay. So Boaz waited for God to reveal the outcome, but he acted on the desires the Lord had already worked in his heart, combined with the knowledge of the people and law of the community. Good business sense allowed him to give a proposal strategically. What I mean by that is he went to this guy and he said, okay, you know, the land of Elimelech needs to be redeemed, and you're the next closest relative. And the guy's like, yeah, I'll take the land. And he goes, oh, okay. And then whoever redeems the land also has to redeem everything else that belongs to Elimelech, meaning his daughter-in-law that has no children. And we know the guy said no to that. But it was a very strategic part for him to give one section first and then reveal the, but wait, there's more clause. The what? Bring the hammer down. Yeah. So I thought that was very strategic on his part. And then we read, I mean, I want to point out that Boaz didn't wallow in his circumstances, wondering what would happen. He moved. He took action. He didn't just say, oh, no, woe is me. I missed my chance. I'm not the closest relative. He did something about it and then waited to see if it would pan out. So the point is that waiting doesn't equal wallowing. I'm going to give you a definition. I put the definition in your notes for wallowing, but waiting doesn't equal wallowing. So here's the great definition of wallowing. To roll oneself about in a lazy, relaxed, or ungainly manner. Picture a pig, you know, rolling in the mud, ungainly manner. Or to become or remain helpless. A lot, you know, you always hear this term with wallowing and self-pity, but I never really, it's one of those words, you kind of know what it means, but you don't look up the definition. Becoming or remaining helpless, that mentality that we're helpless, that's not what God wants for us. When he shows us the situation and tells us to move on it, he doesn't want us to be overcome by the potentials. He wants us to move on it and then wait for him to show us the outcome. It's always not going to be what we want, but being obedient and moving when he says move is what's important. Okay. The third waiting was Ruth, who was waiting to do God's will. Ruth, we know, had an undying commitment to Naomi, and that's why she went to Bethlehem with her. She wanted to uphold this commitment and her promise to Naomi, and she was anxious to get moving along with this plan to the degree that she was willing to change the plan that Naomi laid out to a plan that she thought was better, and I'm going to explain that. As I said, Naomi was looking to get Ruth married so that she was cared for. She even said, I want to find you rest, right? I want to find a way to provide rest for you. The word rest that she used, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, M-A-N-O-A-C-H, Manoch, maybe. I don't have that in your notes. But it's a condition of rest and security to be attained through marriage. It's a specific type of rest, rest from worrying about your future, basically. So that's what Naomi was seeking for Ruth. Ruth, on the other hand, wanted Naomi to also be cared for, not just herself. So she changed the wording. When she went to Boaz, Naomi said, go tell Boaz that he's the kinsman, meaning he's your close relative, and that's how you propose marriage. Well, Ruth went and said, you are our I'm not sure how to pronounce this one either. Geol, is that how you pronounce that one? Do you remember, Brenda? Goel, maybe? G-O-E-L. It's this idea of kinsman redeemer. They're two very different terms. Kinsman was just, his only duty was marriage. I'm sorry, his only duty was to buy up land and take care, redeem the land of another countryman. But the kinsman redeemer, the Goel, that provided the Levirate marriage, the redeeming of the land, everything else. So it was a much bigger commitment. So when Ruth went to Boaz, she didn't say, I want you to be my kinsman. She said, I want you to be my, oh no, I'm sorry. The kinsman was just a marriage proposal. Just marriage. I'm sorry, I misquoted myself. The kinsman redeemer was all of that. Okay? You see the difference? So she's adding to the request that Naomi told her to say. She's adding her own extra amount of responsibility that she's asking Boaz for. So she was not asking Boaz to rescue her like Naomi was. She was asking Boaz to redeem both of them, the whole family that was left of Elimelech, is what it comes down to. She asked for more than she was entitled to ask for, just like when she went to the fields to glean. Remember? She asked to glean behind the main workmen, to go before the people who were picking up the sheaves. She's still very bold and yet humble and respectful. Risk-taking. She was all pumped up to start this new season in her life, right? A go-get-em kind of attitude, excitement. And then all of a sudden, she gets benched. This sounds great, but go home and wait. Can you imagine what was going on inside of her? She had to be kind of going crazy on the inside. So she was waiting to do God's will, and she was put on hold. All right, next part we're going to look at, so we looked at these three kinds of waiting. Now we're going to look at three tips on waiting, kind of different ways we wait and how to do that. First, I want to point out this, that God requires different things at different times during our seasons of waiting. God requires different things at different times during our seasons of waiting. Sometimes we're told to quietly lean on Jesus and rest. Other times we're called to actively wait. But we're always told to stay close to Him, seeking Him for guidance and strength. We have three kinds of waiting we're going to look at, or tips for waiting. The first is to sit still. This is what Naomi told Ruth. Sit still. Actually, I'm sorry. This is what I was looking at with Naomi. I could have it wrong, but it's still the right idea. We have to fight the urge to roam and wander around looking for answers and solutions. Fight the urge to get involved, right? When God tells us to wait, we need to just wait. I have a couple Bible references there, but the one that I'm going to read is Isaiah 30:15. Only in returning to me and resting in me will you be saved. This is the Lord speaking to Israel. In quietness and confidence is your strength. I like that. In quietness and confidence is your strength. Now, the prophet Isaiah was talking to the Israelites about a situation dealing with war in this passage, but I think the same thing applies to us when we have this war going on in the inside. And what we do with that on the outside, because our thoughts prompt our behavior, right? So we have to sit quiet and rest in Him and get our confidence through Him. So that's the sitting still. The next tip on waiting is to stand still. This is what we see with Boaz. So the first is kind of external stillness. This one's kind of an internal and external stillness. We move about where and when and how the Lord directs, but when we get there, we stand still and we stand firm and we trust on Him. We don't run away, from impossible or scary situations. This next reference is Exodus 14, 13, and 14. And this is right after Pharaoh finally said, "Get out of my country," to the Israelites. And they take off and they're headed towards the promised land and they cross the Red Sea. And then Pharaoh's army comes after them and they all start screaming and carrying on. And Moses told the people, here's what he says, "Do not be afraid. Just stand still and watch the Lord rescue you today. The Egyptians you see today will never be seen again. The Lord himself will fight for you. Just stay calm." Moses told the people, stand still. Can you imagine the urge to run away from Pharaoh and his army while you're standing just at the edge of the Red Sea? And they're coming with chariots and fire and hundreds of thousands of men or whatever they had. And then he says, just stay still. Just stand still. I've been like, yeah, right, Moses. So God tells us to stay still. There's a time to march and a time to stand. And you must be in touch with the Lord enough to know when he says to stand or when he says to start walking. But the Lord wanted them to see his hand in action in that situation, because as they stood still, they saw him just totally consume that Egyptian army. Okay, one more verse for this one. 2 Thessalonians 3:11 to 13. "Yet we hear that some of you are living idle lives, refusing to work and meddling in other people's business. We command such people and urge them in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and work to earn their own living. As for the rest of you, dear brothers and sisters, never get tired of doing good." So this is an example from the New Testament about not being idle, not being still, meaning that we're supposed to work until God tells us not to work, right? We have to know when he's saying march, when he's saying stand. In this case, the people were talking about Christ returning, and Paul was saying, don't just wait. Don't be idle. Do things while you're waiting. Do good. Do God's work while you're waiting. And it doesn't mean they're counteracting what they're waiting for. It means they're using their time effectively in the waiting. We can also be called to do works while we're waiting for the next assignment. So we might be waiting to hear, and I'm going to use Paula as an example because this is perfect. She was so desperate for a new job, and she really thought she had this new job. And she could have just said, you know what, I got 4 months of leave because I never take vacation. I'm out of here, and I'm going to start my new job soon. But she didn't. She kept doing that job that she was tired of until God released her from it. And she's still doing that old job. But the point is, she didn't just sit idle. She did what God asked her to do while she was waiting for a new job. Sorry to pull you out, but it's a good example. Okay, so we need to keep loving others, keep doing good, keep seeking how to grow closer to the Lord, keep doing the things that he asks us to do every day while we're waiting for answers in whatever area we're waiting for. And then another thing that he may ask us sometimes to do while we're waiting is to be still. And you all know this verse, Psalm 46:10, "Be still and know that I am God." This is an internal stillness. It doesn't mean Ruth couldn't have been washing dishes and cooking dinner while she was waiting for an answer, but the internal stillness. Do not allow yourself to get anxious or restless while you're waiting. Do not allow the enemy to spur you into action that you're not called to do. Do not allow your heart to be overwhelmed with anxiety. Rest in the Lord. Trust in him. Be still, the word that's used in this passage from Ruth, literally means to take your hands off, to release it into God's hands, relax. What's that old 80s saying, let go and let God? That's what it means, that kind of attitude. Philippians 1:6, "And I am certain that God, who began a good work within you, will continue his work until it is finally finished on the day when Christ Jesus returns." So this passage should give us peace to trust and trust to get through the waiting and be a witness in the process. all of those kind of together. So the question is, how do you wait? And what are you waiting for right now? What is your natural tendency or temptation or your natural kind of MO while you're waiting? And what can you do to take steps toward waiting as the Lord would have you to wait? You know, if you're naturally a fixer, he might be pressing on you to stop trying to fix it in the waiting, you know? If you're naturally a worrier and you get paralyzed, he might be asking you to actually do other things in the waiting. And the beauty of that is sometimes it's a good distraction, you know? He can provide good distractions. So the point is, when we wait on God, we can do so with confidence. He's not going to just ask us to wait for no good reason. He's doing other things. When we wait on God, we can do so with confidence. Confidence that he will finish the work. Confidence that he will not leave us alone. And confidence that he will strengthen us. Isaiah 40:31. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. And they shall walk and not faint. It's funny because I was checking the internet for something real quick, unrelated to this, right before I left the house. So this was already way done. And I went on the internet, and there was a thing about an eagle, and it said when it storms, all the other birds take refuge, but the eagle, I don't know if this is true or not, but it was pretty inspirational. All the other birds take refuge and hide, but the eagle soars above the storm. And I thought, that's a really cool image to go with this verse, you know, that we can have that confidence and soar above our situations when we rest in the Lord, when we take his strength. So waiting is difficult, but we all know that often when we decide to help things along, they get muddled up. It's hard to rein in and control all those anxious and antsy feelings of helplessness, that we could be doing something better with our time. And those anxious and restless feelings, they're not from the Lord. He's a God of peace and calm. The enemy is the one that spurs those feelings, hoping to get us to act where we are to, when we are to sit, to speak when we ought to be silent, to post something on the internet when we ought to just log off, right? He's the one that spurs us on, so we have to be aware of that. Next point, last one about waiting. God is always working during periods of waiting, even if we are not aware. I think we've said this before in this study, that God's always at work even if we don't see him. God is always working during periods of waiting, even if we are not aware. He could be doing a work behind the scenes to prepare a new job opening or make a desired item available for purchase. He could be doing a work in the heart of the one that's sitting quietly, or he could be doing a work in the heart of the one pursuing options during the waiting. Make no mistake that God is never idle. And when we talked about the Sabbath this summer during our summer study, for those of you who may not have been there, I'll tell you this one cool point. Was that when God created the Sabbath, that was part of creation. When he hit that seventh day and said, this is a day of rest, that was still an act of creation. It was the seventh day of creation. It wasn't the first day of the rest of eternity. So it's in that section for a reason. So the resting in the Lord is still part of the waiting. It's still part of that action. Okay. Second part is on redemption. Let me read this passage for you. Well, I'm not going to, because that's the one that's just the, hey, you can buy this property. Hey, you have to take the wife. No, I don't want to. that's the quick and dirty. Yeah. Okay. So a couple reminders from when Brenda taught a couple weeks ago about the kinsman redeemer role. Three things, and you have this on your notes with some scriptures attached, should hopefully, yeah. Three things that the person would be redeemed from or could be redeemed from would be slavery, poverty, and death. And then we had also discussed that the one doing the redeeming had to be a relative, a close relative, had to be able to take on that task, and had to be willing to do it, right? Okay, I think I did not put this in your, oh, I did put it in your notes. Okay, so here's this guy's, okay. here's this guy's name, or at least a word that's referred to him, Poloni. Sounds an awful lot like baloney to me, but that's his name. That's not his name. That's what they use to refer to this guy. In some of the translations, it says Boaz called him over. Let's see. In the New King James, it says, so the close relative came by. Well, some translations might say Poloni. That was the original word used, or so-and-so. So this word Poloni means kind of like so-and-so, Mr. So-and-so, Mr. What's-his-face, that kind of idea. But what it technically translates to in Hebrew is we don't use his name. Like, we don't say his name. And I thought of that, like today you might say Mr. X, you know, or something like that. But I thought that was so interesting. We don't use his name. So Mr. What's-his-name, Boaz approaches him, goes through this whole proposal, and the guy says, I'm not willing. He was a relative, and he was able, but he was not willing to redeem Ruth. So he gave up his right of redemption. For what reason did we read? To make a name for himself, right? Somebody said it earlier. It might mess, oh, Tracy just said it, might mess up his inheritance, okay? So what that means, if you weren't here for group last week, was that either he may have already had his own family, and he didn't want to have to share that with his family, but really, regardless of whether or not he did, suppose he took Ruth on as his wife to create a name for Elimelech and took Elimelech's fields and then had an heir for Elimelech. Well, that field would then go to Elimelech's heir, okay? Little Bobby would get the fields. And any money that would come from those fields down the road would go to little Bobby and not to so-and-so. So he was like, I am not willing to raise this kid, put all my money into his field just to let him have it back. So that's some kind of love, right? But that was the real deal. He's like, I can't do that. I'm not willing to sacrifice money that would go into my own property to make property for somebody else. And that was his right. Because he wasn't a brother of Ruth's husband, there was no shame in that. It just wasn't like he wasn't a team player, basically. Because I'm going to say this now so I don't forget it. We mentioned it when we first way back talked about Hesed, that there's things in the Hebrew Israelite culture that we just can't understand. One, because we don't live back then. But two, their religion, it wasn't like, it's not like us. You know, we're Christians living in America, and for the most part, except for things that are starting to happen in our society now, we can do both. You know, our faith and most of what we do on a regular daily basis don't collide necessarily. Their culture was their faith. It was so deeply intertwined, and that's how God meant it, so that they would be set apart from all other peoples, and he would make a name for himself through the Israelite people. So you couldn't separate their faith from their lifestyle. It was too ingrained with each other. So men in that time would have been told, this is what you do. You take care of each other. You look out for each other. Everybody else on the planet is our enemy, and we have to take care of each other. But remember, in this period of time, what did we study the very first passage? Everyone did as whatever was right in their own minds, right? So so-and-so thought, I don't have to do that anymore because things are changing. But Boaz was still old school enough to believe in taking care of each other, regardless of the cost. The whole point of the kinsman redeemer was to further the kingdom of Israel, not just a brethren's kids, but the whole kingdom of Israel. So it was a bigger picture than just giving Ruth a baby, you know. He knew there was a chance she couldn't have kids anyway. She was married for 10 years and never had one. All right, had to throw out that little background. So-and-so wasn't willing. Okay. But the thing that I thought about with him was the reason he did not take on this role, and he says it very clearly, is I want to make a name for myself. And what do we learn in the New Testament, Matthew 19, verse 30? Jesus said, but many who are the greatest now will be least important then. And those who seem least important now will be the greatest then. So the irony is, this guy wanted to make a name for himself, and now nobody knows his name. They call him, we don't use his name. They didn't use his name anymore. Isn't that ironic? All right. So the other thing, the other thing from the New Testament that I wanted to point out was Luke 12, 33, 34. Jesus says, sell your possessions and give to those in need. This will store up treasure for you in heaven. And the purses of heaven will never get old or develop holes. Your treasure will be safe. No thief can steal it and no moth can destroy it. Wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will be also. So Jesus is telling us we need to look at the big picture. We need to look at the bigger plan, not just do what's going to profit us now financially, but do what's going to further the kingdom, and even if we never see the outcome of it, right? Like filling shoeboxes, right? To give kids in other countries a peek at the gospel. So what is your motivation for decisions and actions? Is it to get some fame, a name for yourself, an attaboy, or is it to do what God would have you do, to bring glory and honor to him, to bless another person and love on somebody else, even if no one is watching? That's the thing. What do we do when nobody else is watching? So our point is here's a good point. Those who are redeemed are called to redeem others. Those who are redeemed are called to redeem others. Now, we don't see anything that tells us about Boaz being redeemed, right? But thousands of years prior, the whole of Israel was redeemed from Egypt. And therefore, they're all to help redeem each other, their entire culture. Any of us who claim faith in Jesus have been redeemed from death and our old life. So we're called in whatever way God shows us to help redeem others, whether that's just giving somebody a smile or paying it forward or sharing the whole blown out gospel with them, right? So what sacrifice are you willing to make when God prompts you to help? That's a hard one. Because sometimes he asks us to do hard things. Time, money, give up our rights, sacrifice all kinds of things. We're going to talk more about that at our last session. Okay, now we're going to shift gears a little bit. Just like Boaz was willing to do more for Ruth than was expected, Jesus does this for us. He didn't just rescue us. He saved us and redeemed us. He didn't come in and wipe away our debt. Have you ever thought, I know we hear about the gospel all the time, and sometimes it just kind of, we hear it so much, there's a tendency or a danger of us kind of not really getting the depth and the bigness of it. But he didn't come in and wipe the slate clean, just wipe it out and say, okay, I'm the banker and your debt's canceled. He didn't do that. He paid our debt. There's a huge difference that he paid our debt for us, right? He took on the cost himself, then the punishment, the torture, the anguish, the pain, and the death. Boaz, in a similar way, was willing to take on that burden for Ruth and Naomi. Not just Ruth, but Ruth and Naomi. Take on the expense and possibly shame for marrying a woman from Moab, right? Marrying a woman who was younger. We know things were questionable at the threshing floor, so what if there were rumors that got around after they got married, right? So there's a huge risk involved for Boaz, but he was willing to do that. Jesus did even more for us. he went through all of that we were supposed to face due to our sin, and he gave us a new life as part of his family. So I want to look, and I have this on your notes, under Jesus and redemption, just some real quick thoughts. But on the left side, under each letter, is something that was part of the kinsman redeemer role back then. And then after the dash is how Jesus applies, or how that applies to us in our relationship with Jesus. The first one is to redeem the inheritance, okay? They had to further the name of that person who had passed away and had no heir, to redeem that inheritance of that person. Well, Christ, we become heirs with Christ. We get to share in his inheritance through salvation, through his redemption of us. And I'm not going to read these scriptures, but I put them there for you to look up later if you want to. The next one was to ensure survival physically and in name of a family member. So even though Elimelech had been long gone, his sons were gone, any children that would be born to Ruth and Boaz would be of the family of Elimelech. So it was preserving his name, his legacy, even though he was gone. Jesus, when we are redeemed by him, we have eternal life. So we get to be preserved in legacy with him. When they were redeemed, if they were bought out of slavery or poverty, their place in that family was restored, right? They were brought back into that family of believers, so to speak. We become children of God when we're redeemed through Jesus. So we're brought into that family. When somebody would redeem one that was sold into slavery, or they could redeem one who was sold into slavery. For us, we're set free from the burden of sin because our debts have already been paid. So we're redeemed from that slavery too, of sin and death, or being a slave to our sin, I should say. And one of the duties of a kinsman redeemer, we didn't discuss it in this particular passage because there were no wrongdoings, but if somebody had been murdered or brutally treated, the kinsman redeemer would avenge that person. So we see that Jesus plays that role for us as well, because we know one day he's going to defeat our enemy. He's already defeated death, and then ultimately he's going to defeat our enemy. So we don't have to do that. We don't have to fight that fight necessarily, because we know it's going to happen. So God was the redeemer of Israel. Isaiah 60:16, it says, "You shall know that I, the Lord, am your Savior and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob." So God told them long ago that he was their Redeemer. And then in 1 Peter, we read that Jesus redeems those who come to faith in him. Here's what it says. "For you know that God paid a ransom to save you from the empty life you inherited from your ancestors. And the ransom he paid was not mere gold or silver. It was the precious blood of Christ, the sinless, spotless Lamb of God. God chose him as your ransom long before the world began, but he has now revealed him to you in these last days." So he didn't just provide, like with Ruth and Naomi, all of a sudden, hey, this guy is our kinsman redeemer, right? God revealed who the solution would be. God revealed to us 2,000 years ago who our Redeemer was. It's up to us now to take that on or to accept it. So if we thought Boaz might have made some kind of risky move trying to go ahead and redeem Ruth and Naomi, how about Jesus? He was motivated for love for each of us, for a desire for that family of God to remain intact. And it was also risky. I don't know if any of us ever consider how risky that was for him. But he could have died on that cross, suffered everything he did, and not had a single person believe in him afterwards. There was a risk involved there. We kind of take it for granted that everybody did because we read about it after the fact, but there was no guarantee that anybody would follow him and not just turn away and walk away from the cross and never look back. So that was a real huge risk. But he took a chance because he loves us. He would have done it for any one of us individually, right? So this story with Ruth and Boaz and Naomi, it's not just about rescuing. It's not just about redemption, as important as the redemption is. But it's also about restoration, about restoring what was lost. When Boaz sent Ruth home with that big, huge bundle, and one thing I read said it could have been a bundle big enough for a donkey to have to carry it, and poor little Ruth was humping down the road with this giant thing on her back. Somebody was going to ask some kind of questions about that, right? This big bundle of grain was to symbolize a promise and provision. Naomi returned to town. What did she say? "I'm empty. I have nothing," right? She said, "I went away full and I came back empty. I went away with family. I came back alone. I went away alive and vibrant. I'm coming back dead and bitter," right? So he's sending back this grain as a promise to say, look, now you have family. Now you're going to have a home. One way or another, by the end of the day, you're going to have a home. You're going to have a future. She went, by the end of chapter 4, we're going to see that she went from having nothing but Ruth, which was a huge something, but she didn't see it, to having this huge lineage that leads all the way to Christ. Okay? So the point is that God alone is equipped to redeem and restore, turning lives upside down. Boaz is a picture of this practically in real life with Ruth. But God alone is equipped to redeem and restore, turning lives upside down. He can take a life and take it from empty to full, dead to alive, alone to having family. And like Pastor Tom always says, it won't make our life perfect. It won't be necessarily easy, but our life can be full and full of peace, joy, and love when we follow Jesus, right? So the idea, here's our last little section, but I think it's so important. The idea that Boaz was willing to redeem this foreign girl and bring her in as a part of the family of God, the nation of Israel, God's chosen people, is the very idea of the gospel. It's the gospel being preached many generations before the Messiah of Israel would ever enter the scene. Okay, so I have a couple things in your notes just to help you think on that, to follow along. But from Genesis, we read the story of creation. In Revelation, we read the end of the story. And if you think about it, everything in the middle, starting at chapter 3 of Genesis even, everything in the middle is the gospel story laid out for us in one way or another. God's love poured out in an attempt to restore what was lost during the fall. Before the fall, Adam and Eve walked in relation with God. They had no shame. They didn't have to work to earn their place. It was an intimate relationship. It was eternal. There was no death at that point. And it was by God's grace. They didn't have to work for this relationship. It was just there, freely given to them. After the fall, they were separated from God spiritually and physically. Death came into play, and they had to work for restoration and relationship. Not only did they have to work to get their food, but bigger than that, they had to work at restoring this relationship with the Lord by keeping the law, which was really hard. I mean, we have it so easy compared to them. Christ came, and he redeemed all that was lost in the garden. We get access to this intimate relationship with God through the Spirit. We're promised spiritual life now and eternal life in heaven, and we can only take hold of this through grace. We can't earn it through our works. Actually, our work as believers, this is one of your points, is faith. A believer's work is faith. That's the only work we're required to do, is have faith. And that's hard sometimes, but that's the one work he requires of us. We've all heard this hundreds of times, but the overall point of this scene is that all that was done for the furthering of the kingdom and the family. And we must remember to not take lightly the gospel of grace and redemption, and also that it should have a bearing on all we do. Everything we do, if we can remember, and I'm not claiming to ever be good at this, but I was very convicted. It's what happens when you're a teacher. Everything we do, we should look at in light of eternity. You know, it should help us make our choices and form opinions and decide on things, the big things in life. You know what? Not what to eat for lunch, but the big things in life, you know? So the last point of this is that Jesus restores us to the relationship with God that was intended right from the beginning of creation. He restores us to that relationship that God wanted us to have in the garden. And that's the only way we can have it restored is through Jesus. But isn't that a beautiful picture that he wants to restore us to that type of relationship and that God even gives us? Sorry that that's a dark screen. I didn't see how dark that was at home. But isn't it beautiful that God even offers a way to restore that which was lost, right? I think it's exciting. Okay. Yeah. So we have a little bit of time. We can get into groups, and you can just use your outline for discussion because I don't have questions for you. Thank you, ladies.